Let's begin with prayer. Loving God, fill us with an awareness of your presence this morning, that we may be at peace and worship you with all of our mind and heart. Amen. When I was in elementary school, my one great love was football. I collected football cards and stickers and those little plastic helmets of the NFL teams that you could get in the machines by the exit of the department store. I watched college and NFL games constantly over the weekends, and my love for playing the game itself led to endless hours outside, kicking and punting and chasing and throwing the football to myself. I had a game where I could cover the 30 yards or so of our yard in three throws to myself, usually requiring an arms outstretched of diving, grass-stained catch. My competitive team play was limited to school recess. And one particularly memorable recess, I lined up against one of the opposing team's top receivers. I got a good look at a short screen pass, and I lunged in front of it at full speed. It was the kind of interception that one can only dream about. There was no one between me and the swing sets that marked my end zone. That touchdown, I think, was in the sixth grade, and my reverie about this story at home led to a serious conversation with my mom about how I wasn't always going to be able to play with the boys this way. Things were going to change. Frankly, at the time, I was confused and devastated, and my mind ran wild with thoughts of the scary transformations that my body was apparently going to go through to make all the joys of my childhood disappear. I became determined to resist. I was familiar with my identity of being a so-called tomboy, but I wasn't sure at all what this next stage of transformation was going to bring. I began thinking about this story and my own gender story and its significant moments over this summer. The 30-plus years since that touchdown have included a lot more confusion, awareness, and resistance. I wrote on Friday in our e-newsletter, First Matters, about when I was traveling this summer that one of the books that I threw in my carry-on was called This Is My Body, Hearing the Theology of Transgender Christians. Our LGBTQ program led by Elder Ben Maddox recommended this book for all of us this summer. And the topics in the book will be a focus of a three-part discussion series come September. While the first half of this book is more scholarly and the second half is comprised of more personal stories, I ended up appreciating how adept all the writers were at weaving the question, what does this have to do with my faith, into the milestones of the transitions in their journeys? One of my favorite parts of the book was one of the appendixes in the back, written by a woman named Michelle Lemorvan, who has since passed away. In this appendix, she highlights the five aspects of her spiritual path that were present with her throughout her journey. She emphasizes that these were not chronological steps, but rather steps and aspects of the journey that were interwoven. She identifies these five areas: awareness, acceptance, surrender, gratitude, and love. As she describes each of these aspects and then considers them as a whole path, she identifies how helpful they were to help her move away from the judgmental aspects of her faith practice that were constantly making her seek approval. as she embraced awareness, acceptance, surrender, gratitude, and love, she was able to live more freely into what she describes as the freedom of the gospel. And we can all identify with moments where these very ideas have turned us one way or another on the path of our spiritual journey. We talk too seldom, though, about the stories of trans people, intersex people, and gender nonconforming friends in the church. And so little do we discuss and listen to their stories, in fact, that we miss a whole level of complexity about our own identities and our own spiritual journeys. Maybe you are better at this than I am, but I find that I'm still awkward with the language in this conversation. I'm wrestling with these stories and this vocabulary has caused me to wrestle with the restrictive ideas of embodiment and gender binaries in critical ways that I hope will make me more compassionate. If we look closely at our own gender stories, we see places and people that challenged us in new ways, both inside and outside the cultural norms. One of the most powerful experiences for me in reading This Is My Body was how articulate many of the writers were about a desire for dialogue, understands gender as something more fluid, and less about categories of fitting into male and female. That emphasis was so different than expressing either one gender or another. One of my favorite articles in the book was written by Chris Dowd, and it was titled, Five Things That Cis Folk Don't Know About Trans Folk Because It Wasn't on Trashy TV, My Right of Reply. One of the ideas he explores in this essay is the assumption that trans folk change gender, that for many trans people, they have never seen themselves as cisgender or perceived as the gender into which they were born, but rather they see themselves as contributing to a unique perspective on the dynamics of gender. The challenges we face by hearing trans people share their stories and linking those stories with their spirituality, so we also have to hear the pain that restrictive interpretations of scripture have caused. For example, too often the creation story in Genesis, especially chapter 1, verse 27, is used to suggest that God created human beings as male or female, that one or the other harms trans and gender non-conforming identities and misses the God who is created male and female, embracing a God who is the image of both and all the dynamic that flows in between. There are texts in our scriptures that have been used to harm, and that sadness is something that we should hold and not try to make excuses for or interpret away. Reinterpreting these texts is also important. But I want to suggest today that we have an opportunity to go a step further. It is a step that Will and Nicole and Ben and I have discussed a lot in our conversations about the discussion series that we are planning about this book. There's a question we have asked ourselves: what if we look at texts like the ones we heard Julie and Will read today and juxtapose these with questions related to spiritual aspects of trans folks' journeys? What could we learn by considering what our faith stories share about identity transitions? Could we learn something new about ourselves and our discipleship? The stories that our tradition tells us over and over again actually affirm that identity issues are important. The passage from Matthew's community that Will read for us this morning is yet another great example. I love this dialogue between Jesus and the disciples. First of all, Jesus is up to his usual word-parsing shenanigans when he asks them the first question, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" He doesn't lead with asking them the straightforward question about who people say he is. And their answers reflect this distance from him. They reply, "Well, people say the Son of Man is Elijah or John the Baptist or one of the prophets." They don't affirm that he is the Son of Man in that first question. But what I love about this question is that it is a question about presentation. What does the Son of Man look like? What is their name? After hearing the disciples' answers, Jesus then shifts right into the crux of the gospel's biggest identity question. Who is he? And he asks them, "What about you? Who do you say that I am?" Listen to that again. He doesn't ask them, "Who do you say the Son of Man is?" He shifts. "Who do you say that I am?" He gives them the answer. He is the Son of Man. Do they know it? I love Peter's answer, but I wish that Jesus' response wasn't all about Peter. Or maybe I wish Peter had answered and then asked Jesus, "Who do you say that you are?" All of the gospel communities worked hard and in various ways to address the issues of Jesus' identity. Mostly his human-divine identity that we see in these verses, but that wasn't all. They also wrestled with his relationship to his Judaism, his cultural identity, his class, his education. How did he know how to teach in the synagogues the way that he did? And they questioned his identity in his family roots. Wasn't he the son of a carpenter? Who were his mother, his brothers? It would have been great in this moment in the gospel to hear him articulate who he was. Jesus seems to be affirming Peter's perception of who he is, but then he does this curious thing. You heard Will say it. He orders the disciples not to tell anyone who he is. I understand Jesus' caution, and yet when I think about that silence in relation to the stories of trans people that we've been talking about today, I feel sad. I think we've come to hear Jesus silencing his disciples as a kind of humility, or an intimate knowledge that he knew when things were supposed to happen. And we brush it away too quickly. Brushing it away allows us to miss an important part of Jesus' own identity transformation. Jesus is wrestling with how to hide who he is. Jesus had to wrestle with how people perceive him and how he presented himself. Jesus had to wrestle with how he described himself, with how he says who he is. The issue of hiding and calling out assumptions is a significant aspect of sexual identity and gender identity, especially for those who do not fit into heteronormative and gender normative categories. One of the obvious and yet thought-provoking parts of the stories in Chris Dowd's article that I've been highlighting today is this beautiful paragraph about the people he interviewed, where he says, "The people I met and interviewed were not gender rebels. They did not want to overturn binary gender or create radical theology or challenge church systems and structures. They simply wanted to be unremarkable people worshiping quietly in church communities which valued them as fellow Christians. Their greatest ambition was to blend in, not stand out." That desire to blend in sounds a lot like what Jesus was dealing with in this story about his identity. Hearing these gospel stories in conjunction with gender stories helps us hold the individuality and the universality of all these stories more fully. Jesus will eventually have to stand out. And our goal might be to stand with our trans Christian friends in ways that embraces them, whether they want to stand out or blend in. And when we begin to really hear the stories of trans people, we can't help but be challenged to think about our own identities in new ways. And in doing so, we learn more about ourselves and our gifts, and more about others and their gifts. Even if we are clunky with our language, as I'm sure I have been today, that exploration gives us a chance to learn more, to be more articulate and more compassionate. In Jesus' story, we see these aspects of the spiritual path and how he navigates them. The truth of the matter is, we all know the experience of feeling lost to ourselves and having to reorient who we are and how people perceive us. We are people who struggle with depression and addiction. We feel guilty when our expectations of ourselves and from others stifle us. We are all people who seek approval and answers instead of singing our own song. Our trans siblings and our faith have a lot to teach us, and we can share in the knowledge that awareness and assurance, surrender, gratitude, and love will carry us a long way, whoever we are. Michelle Lemorvin, who I mentioned earlier, used this quote from Anthony DeMello as her closing. And it is a good closing for this sermon as well. It sums up the interactions in our journey of discipleship in a way that is worth taking forward into the world. "I am satisfied to do my thing, to dance my dance and have done with it." According to a sentence I read somewhere, a bird does not sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song. I am content to sing my song.